Mr. W.R. Page, Reel 3. When you were firing these guns into the hills, can you tell me about what type of gun you were using and what height you were at and the type of plane you were using?
Yeah, we were using a Lewis gun. It was fastened on to the scarf ring, it was called, in the rear cockpit of the Hawker Ordex. And it was one of these scarf rings that you'd swing your gun round about 90 degrees. And these were the type of guns we were using. The other point was, how high were we? Oh, we'd be about 1,500 feet above ground level. The some of the hilltops were 2,000 feet, so we'd be just below the summit of the hills. And you couldn't see anybody. Whether or not everybody heard immediately heard an aircraft engine coming in their direction or not, but you very seldom saw any movement at all. It just so happened this morning we've been told to go and clear out this hilltop. We saw any movement, and I saw some movement, and I must confess it could have been imagination, or it could have been the wind, or it could have been some people, but I saw some movement on this hillside, so I pointed the pilot to it. He flew straight and level for me whilst I fired these rounds into this hill. But that was all that I ever saw. Village life seemed to me not to be very organised in the mountains. You didn't have a kind of village unit very much. Whether the people were nomads and would probably come out from Peshawar for a month or some of these other established communities and then go out into the hills and then come back home again, that I wouldn't know, but I mean, it could well be that, but certainly there were no sort of village communities.
What type of planes were you using, did you say?
Ordaxes. They're the Hawker family. There was the Hawker Ordax and the Hawker Hart. The Hawker Hart had stub exhausts, so the exhausts came out in front of the pilot and were all right for day flying. Of course, at night time it would blind them. And the Hawker Ordaxes were a similar aircraft, very same design, but they had a long exhaust that reached back to the tail, so it protected the pilot from the glare of the exhaust manifolds, the short exhausts. So the Hawker Ordaxes, of course, we were equipped with Hawker Ordaxes. Our first aircraft was the Wapiti, the Bristol Wapiti. And then they went out and we had these Hawker aircraft. At the end we had a few Lysanders brought in.
And about what type of speed were you going at on these missions?
About 150, 200 miles an hour airspeed. That would be about the airspeed, I would think. 200 miles, 250, something of the sort.
And these planes were specially built for the purpose of aerial photography, were they?
Oh, no. They were built... The Hawker Ordax was built for army cooperation, for night flying and things of this sort. And that was the difference. That's where they were modified from the Hawker Hart. They were... No, not built for that. They were actually built as, I think they were built as an interceptor in the first place, fighters. Because they were a very sleek aircraft compared with the Wapitis that we'd had previously. They were a biplane with a Kestrel engine. Fabric, of course, made of fabric. I must say that I can't ever remember us being fired at from the ground. Although we used to get reports from the army that they used to, when they used to send their convoys through the Kohat Pass and round that area, that they used to ring bullet holes that they had in their lorries before they went. So if there were any holes that weren't ringed when they got to their destination, they knew they'd been fired on, you see, because it could quite well happen. And we used to get all kinds of tales about how they had been fired on, how the winding mountain passes would have a blockade of boulders put just round the corner, which compel the army vehicles to slow down, and then they used to be fired on from the hills as they were slowing down. They were sort of stationary targets almost. So we were told all this about when we met some of the army boys, but I must say that it was something that we didn't experience.
You never heard of any plane being shot at?
No, we never had. I can't ever remember a bullet hole in a plane. No, I can't.
Did you ever hear of any of these bombing missions whilst you were serving in India?
No, there were. It may well have been that some other squadrons were bombing squadrons, and they may have done some from Peshawar or one of these RAF places, but we were purely army cooperation people, therefore our mission, although we used to carry bombs, our missions were not bombing missions, and we used to come back again. I can't even remember a bomb being dropped. They were always taken off your aircraft when you returned.
Were there any Indians in the Air Force?
This is very interesting. Of course, we had Gurkha regiments guarding us all the time we were in the frontier. And then at my latter period of my service in India, we had some Indians who were attached to our squadron. And I know we used to have a lot of hesitation about saluting Indian officers. Somehow, I must confess, we didn't used to salute the British officers very much in the RAF. I never did, because I never wore a hat. I used to hold my hat in my... Well, my flying helmet used to be off in my hand and that sort of thing. But there was a real hesitation about this, very, very concern about these Indians coming in. But I thoroughly enjoyed flying with the Indian pilots. I used to have to take them up and put them through the routine of taking photographs and so on. In 1939, I'm jumping a bit now, I came home in August 1939. I can remember in early 39 when there was all the talk about the war coming off. We had three photographers in our processing department who used to process the films that I used to take. And we had three Indians being trained for this. And one of them used to always be talking about this coming war in Europe. And one of the lads said, he said, "We are welcoming this coming war in Europe, because you white people will be so involved in killing yourselves, you won't have the time to concentrate on India, and then we shall be able to get our freedoms." And his colleague used to say, "Don't take any notes of him. He's a communist, you know. Don't you take any notes of him." And I can remember that very well.
Who was this chap who said this?
He was a... lad working in the processing department, photographic processing department, learning how to lay out these mosaic photographs and how to process films and things of the sort for the aerial survey work.
What was your reaction when he said that to you?
Well, I thought about it, because I knew I'd be one of the first to die. Because we were the trained RAF personnel at that time, and I remember I spoke to my pilot about it. One of my pilots was Vivian Van Damme, one of the Windmill Girl theatre people. And I was telling him about it. He said, "Well," he said, "he's probably quite right, you know." He said, "If we get involved in a real war in Europe, and it's quite on the cards, we shall be so involved in that, it could be that our whole of our empire will disappear, because we shan't be able to police it as we have been doing over the last... ever since it's been an empire." I remember him saying this to me, but I must confess this was something that I'd never given much thought about, except I took this on board when they said this and thought, well, yes, this is quite a possibility.
Did that worry you, the thought of losing the empire?
Not a bit, no, because I could see that we were not really uplifting the Indian peoples as we'd been told we were doing when I was a kid. I think I told you earlier about Sunday school teacher was telling us we're giving a lame dog a helping hand. Well, all the time I was in India, I never saw this. What I saw was that the English population out there were out there to drink as many chota pegs as they could, get as much money as they could, and retire as early as they could. And the last thing they ever considered was that they were really serving a purpose to the Indian nation and helping to uplift them in any way at all. And I must, I had some experiences out there which suggests to me that the Indians could have done a lot of uplifting for us.
What type of experiences?
Well, I was very fortunate. I'd only been out there about 2 years, and the sergeant in charge of the photographic department was going back to England, and he was a married man with his wife living there, so he had made contact with certain people outside the cantonment in which we were confined as forces. And he said to me one day, would you like to come down and meet some of my friends before I go away, because they have so much enjoyed having contact with people from Britain that it'll be a disaster to them when I go back home and they've got no contacts. So I went with him, and we met this lady. Oh, she'd be about 70, I suppose. And her and my friend, the sergeant, and his wife and I played bridge with this old lady, and she loved this, and she was so excited to think that she knew he was going home, that there would be a continuity, that I would probably continue to go. So I did continue to go down there quite frequently playing bridge, and when he left, she invited two Roman Catholic priests to come in, so we had our foursome for our bridge games. And one evening when I was there, I met a lad, an Indian lad. I think he was called a Munshi, a man who could speak English. It's English teaching or something. And I used to talk to him about things, and he used to ask me what was my impressions of India, and I used to say, well, I must confess that we're very isolated from India, really. We've got our own little piece of England, and that's our cantonment. So he said, well, if you come down here, I'll take you out, if you like, to meet some Indians. And we used to go on a bicycle out across the Mayadan, I think we used to call it, across the desert. He used to take me to these little villages. They'd be about 5, 6, 10 miles away from the RAF station. Of course, I wasn't supposed to go there, but I went and thoroughly enjoyed every moment of it, meeting these people. And I saw some of the most beautiful artistic buildings and some of these little remote Indian villages. I remember I went to one place where they had a dance, and there was a girl in the middle who was dancing, and she had to sort of do this kind of folk dance where she was persuading a boy, not necessarily to fall in love with her, to be attracted to her by her dancing. And we were all standing in this ring, and she came to me and started dancing in front of me, and the person in charge, wherever he was, asked her, come away from him, don't do that to him because he is English, or something like this, what the Munshi was explaining to me all the time. But it was a tremendous experience to find out the very cultured way the Indian peoples lived who were away from the cantonments. But the nearer you got to the cantonment, the more commercialized the Indian had become. He'd become a complete, he used to earn his living from the forces. Naturally used to be very servile to the forces. There was one lad I had as a servant, a bearer, we used to call them, a servant. And he came to me in tears one day and said that the canteen contractor was responsible for all the bearers in the camp, the RAF camp at Ambala. And he had decided to withdraw his credentials. And he told me he thought it was because another bearer had got some relative he wanted to work in his place. And so I said, well, look, I've got to have a word with this contractor. And I went to see the contractor and said, I understand that our bearer is leaving, and I take exception to this. He's an excellent lad, and I wouldn't want another bearer seeing after me. I'm very happy with him. And anyway, I must have impressed him. He must have wondered perhaps whether I was going to up to higher authorities on this, that he decided, it transpired later, that he allowed this lad to carry on. And I had a letter from this lad. I can't find lad, obviously written by a professional scribe, thanking me for what I'd done. And I always remember it finished up with, and wishing you long life in high ranks. I remember this. Incidentally, I think he said he had two or three wives and several children to keep, and it would have been a disaster for him to have lost this job. But him and all the bearers and the fruit waller that used to come in were very servile to the British. It wasn't until you got the northwest frontier, you got to Kohat, Peshawar, and these places that you met a new different type of Indian, a very, very fine, stalwart, dignified person, and would look you straight in the eye, no messing about it, you know. But in the around the cantonments, they were very, very servile. But when you got out into these villages with this Munshi, I thoroughly enjoyed going round there and meeting them, and they thoroughly enjoyed my company. They used to come along, and through him used to talk to me about things and what they were doing, and I used to ask them what they lived on, because I couldn't make out what they lived on. You see, I'd come from a very highly agricultural area, and they used to explain to me how they had difficulty in living, and they couldn't get water. And I used to say to them, well, you could do with some of our lorries that we've got in the camp here, couldn't you? Carting some stuff for you and ploughing your land. And this is what they needed. We'd got all this mechanical stuff on our camp for pulling the aircraft about and doing it. It would have been very useful on their land, helping to till their soil for them.
The lady you used to play bridge with, the Indian lady...
She was English.
Oh, she was English.
She was... Well, whether she was Anglo-Indian, I think it's called. I think she was English. She was Irish. She came from Ireland because she was annoyed that De Valera should have changed the name of Ireland to Ira. To the Ira, isn't it? Ira, you know. Southern Ireland. So, no, she came from Ireland. And very early, she'd been there nearly all her life. Her husband and her went out there as young people. And his job was, as far as I can remember, going round the various areas as a judge. A kind of travelling magistrate, I suppose, or something of this sort. He was dead and she'd settled in Ambala. And her mother was somehow associated with the Black Hall of Calcutta. Is this possible? I seem to remember her telling me about this.
Her mother?
Yeah.
Probably much earlier than that, I would have thought.
She was generation. 70. She'd be 70 in 1935, 6.
Black Hall of Calcutta, you see, was about 1750.
Oh, it could have been a grandmother. Some distant... Because they were the people that attracted her and her husband to come out to India, you see, her previous...
So it was one of these families with long-standing Indian
connection. Yes, yes. And her son was working out up in them forests as a forester in charge of large areas of forestry, cutting the trees and things of this sort. But,
did you have much contact with British civilian population apart from this particular family?
No, you had no contact with the British civilian population at all. In fact, when I used to go on these cycle rides, they lived a very peculiar life, the English people out there. They were quite an isolated little group. And I can remember some notice they used to have on their gate. And I think it was whether they were at home or if they weren't at home for their... neighbours to come and visit them. There would be certain periods when their neighbours couldn't visit them and things of this sort. I can't remember. No, we were quite isolated from them. I did go to out on manoeuvres one day, and the train broke down. We were going by train for some reason or other, train broke down and we stopped at a railway. We were eventually pulled into a railway siding, and here we had a couple of days with people who had had, who'd come originally, or their families had come from England and had settled there and were working on the railways. And I had a very good time with them, and I did enjoy that. They were the only real contact I had with the white civilian population. They were mostly white.
What type of job did he do?
They were dealing with railway. They were mostly railway work. There was a repair siding there where they were doing repair work on trains and things of this sort. And I can't remember the name of the place now, but I can remember the situation very well, because I know we formed a football team and played them at football and this kind of thing. And of course they were very excited to meet people who were more or less straight from Britain, you know, because they'd been out there and they'd presumably married very closely. You know, their children would probably be, there'd be a very close relationship between marriages and things of this sort, but there was such an isolated area. I can't remember the name of the place.
Were any of them married to Indians, or had they all married English people?
Well, they must have married Indians, because there were some Anglo-Indian girl youngsters about there playing tennis. I can remember seeing some there, Anglo-Indian youngsters there, so there must have been. Of course, when this it's an unusual situation. If you get a girl, an Anglo-Indian girl, they used to try very hard to get either an army bloke or a white, an English person to marry. And they used to check on your history to make sure that you were absolutely white, because they didn't want to have an Indian throwback in their family, you know, this kind of thing. I can remember this old lady, for instance, where I went to stay, where I used to go and play bridge with her. Her daughter, who would be about 50, I suppose, had got a daughter of about 20. And they used to bring her up there to meet me quite frequently. And I remember the old lady saying to me one day, "My daughter would like you to be very interested in my granddaughter, because we're certain that there'd be no throwback of the colour situation, you know, there'd be white children." I can remember the old lady saying this very much.
Was the granddaughter Anglo-Indian, or was she English?
She was English, yeah.
Did you find that the English civilian population, like this family and the railway people, did you find that they had a different attitude towards India and Indians to the attitude which the RAF men had?
Well, they were... The RAF people didn't have any contact with the Indians as such, except the servants, and they treated them as such. And the white people treated their Indians as servants just the same, but in a more softer way. They were very more paternal towards their Indian servants and so on than what the serving man was. He was rather brutal towards them, very unpleasant towards them. I remember after the Quetta earthquake, it was a terrible situation, after the Quetta earthquake, there was about half a dozen girls came down to Ambala with some kind of written notice from somebody or other in higher authority that said that these girls were victims of the Quetta earthquake and would be entitled to, or should be given sympathetic consideration when they were begging for assistance, money and things of this sort. And I can remember these girls coming into our camp begging, and the boys were not interested in giving them their money, but they took them into the shower bath and gave them a good wash and then enjoyed themselves with them for a while and then gave them some money. I can remember that very well.
These were Indian girls, of course.
Yes, Indian girls from Quetta.
Can we go back to one or two things that you mentioned? You said that when Indian officers came into the RAF, the men in your unit had some hesitation about the question of saluting. Why was that exactly? Can you tell me?
Purely because they were Indian. They had hesitation about saluting our own officers. They were never very happy about doing this, because they were mostly craftsmen in the RAF. They've got some trade, generally speaking, and they there was not a lot of this. Honour that they were officers kind of thing in the RAF. In fact, the officers themselves were very reluctant. They were not very happy about this. They were more or less like factory managers because, as I said, we were a factory complex almost, so there wasn't this kind of military approach to the thing. But when the Indians arrived, of course, we were told that the Indian officers must be treated as the same as our own officers, must receive the same respect. I can remember the final statement that was made was that if you have any hesitation about saluting, remember you're not saluting the man, you are saluting the commission. It was the Queen, the King's commission. And yes, that was what happened. There was a
little. And were they treated with respect?
Ultimately, they were. They were wonderful pilots. As far as we were concerned, anyway, the fitters and the riggers and those that were closely associated with flying held them in very high esteem. In fact, they were beautiful pilots as far as I was concerned because they were so perhaps dedicated and certainly very soft with the handling of the rudder. You know, if I wanted them to swing gradually to the left or the right, the move to the left or right to take my photographs, it was a beautiful. Oh, no, they were beautiful pilots. And naturally, you respect anybody who's got such wonderful qualities in doing their job, and I think this is where it came in.
You suggested that there was quite a difference between the way the RAF went on and the way the army went on. Did you find that the discipline was a lot less strict in the RAF from the impression you could get?
There was really no. Very little discipline in the RAF. As I said, we were more or less an industrial complex. And therefore, there was very little. We didn't do. I can't remember doing any marching much or anything of this sort. Oh, we used to have perhaps a church parade once a year. I think that it was insisted that the British RAF should at least show themselves in the church in Mbala at least once a year. So we used to have a parade down there. About once a year, and put our with our guns, and there was a little catch in front of your seat in the church where you used to fix your gun in, so that it was there for when you come back again. But apart from that, no, there was not any of that kind of thing. We had our guards, of course, night guards, but that didn't affect me because flying people were usually taken off this sort of thing.